Radical love, lavish generosity, extravagant forgiveness, inclusive hospitality, compassionate action, selfless service, a passion for justice, creative nonviolence, simple living. Good day, good people. I'm Robert Farrell. This is Coalesce. Thank you for joining me. Coalesce is grounded in both and thinking, heart wisdom, and listening for the common good arising in dialogue, where we are present to presence. Coalesce provides an opportunity to encounter and discover the multiple perspectives that make our beautiful community. May we see with the eyes of our heart. May we love one another with peace and compassion. May all beings come to know the divine presence within. This is episode 38, Held Together by Love and Divine Presence. In 1965, the Second Vatican Council of the Catholic Church issued its historic conclusions that still stand as inspired and authoritative for many Christians. In the Council's document titled Nostra Aetate, it specifically addressed other world religions, seeing what was good and eternal in each of them. From ancient times down to the present, there is found among various peoples a certain perception of that hidden power that hovers over the course of things and over the events of human history. At times, some indeed have come to the recognition of a supreme being, or even of a father. This perception and recognition penetrates their lives with a profound religious sense. In Hinduism, humans contemplate the divine mystery and express it through an inexhaustible abundance of myths and through searching philosophical inquiry. They seek freedom from the anguish of our human condition either through ascetical practices or profound meditation or a flight to God with love and trust. Hinduism prescribes eternal duties such as honesty, refraining from injuring all living beings, nonviolence, patience, forbearance, self-restraint, tolerance, and compassion. The Hindu texts are very non-dualistic and poetic, opening the spiritual imagination. The Sanskrit language itself seems to allow non-dual thinking, much more than the Western languages, which are often based on the Greek and Latin languages. In Greek and Latin, reality comes across as logical contraries or distinctions with less room for nuanced and various interpretations. Ancient and native languages tend to be more subtle, descriptive, poetic, and non-dualistic than most Western languages, which pride themselves on being clear, definitive, and final. Hinduism has been described as the most tolerant of the world religions, perhaps in part because it honors many gods. This allows many different worldviews and does not require having one official scripture. Because of these qualities, Hinduisms and its many children are able to be much more patient with mystery and multiplicity. So like many Westerners, I grew up knowing almost nothing about Hinduism, even though it is by far the oldest of the great religions. Because many of us had never met a true Hindu or seen Hindu dress, knew of the various gods and temples, it all seemed so foreign to ours, so we did not take Hinduism seriously. That's what happens when everything is seen in reference to oneself. Whenever one's nationality, era, or religion are the only reference points. Most of us likely dismissed Hinduism without ever reading a single text from the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, or much less the ancient Vedas. So we disregarded the usually unconscious commandment of religious people that older is better and closer to the source. We too easily forgot that Christianity is the Johnny come lately as compared to Hindu and Buddhist scriptures and many other spiritual poets, seers, and philosophers besides. Our inclusion of the Jewish scriptures in our own Christian Bible, which is two-thirds of it, should have cued us that we are building on, inclusive of, and dependent on other religions older than ours. Most Christians seem to have never thought of this for some reason. Some practitioners to the ancient texts that formed Hinduism as the eternal law or the eternal way. Hinduism draws upon inspirations, we might now say, from the collective unconsciousness or the eternal one spirit. Western scholars regard Hinduism as a fusion or synthesis of various East Asian cultures and traditions with diverse roots and no single founder. Thus, it is much more comfortable with seeming paradoxes or contradictions. Hinduism begins with complete confidence in the One, whereas Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, while calling themselves monotheistic, are actually much more preoccupied with the parts than the whole. Within Hindu scriptures, each story or text seems to stand on its own, and yet in the end creates a rather mystical worldview. Christians must be honest enough to know that the Holy Spirit was not first discovered on Pentecost Sunday somewhere around the year 30 AD. Surely Peter was right when he said in Acts 10:34-35, "The truth that I have come to realize is that God does not have favorites, and anybody of any nationality who respects the divine and does what is right is acceptable to him." The majority of human creation cannot possibly have been just a throwaway exercise on the part of what would then be a very indifferent and inefficient God. Yet the three monotheistic religions often seem to act as if that were the case, as if God did not start becoming God until we came along. Of course, if our imagined God is that indifferent, it allows us to be quite indifferent too. Whereas a God of all the earth, as we see in Psalm 48 and throughout the Hebrew scriptures, will inevitably create people of all the earth. Let us take this moment to connect with God of all the earth. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. Christian scholar Raimundo Panikkar lived from 1918 to 2010, and Panikkar's intellect and spirit astounded all who read him or heard him. Some of his over 40 books include The Silence of God, Christophany, A Dwelling Place for Wisdom, and The Experience of God. Each had a twofold meaning and seemingly opposite effect on many readers. They simultaneously felt that they were in the earliest stages of spiritual understanding compared to Panikkar, but they equally felt invited, enlightened, and included inside of something that was universal and available to all. Somehow, Panikkar's ancient roots, stellar mind, and his Christian love all came through. He saw the Christ as the fully adequate Christian symbol for the whole of reality. I never felt Panikkar compromised his Christian belief, even though he was quite able and willing to use metaphors for the same experience from Hinduism and Buddhism. As a matter of fact, his mother was Spanish and his father was Hindu. It was his Hinduism that often led Panikkar to the depths and the full believability of his Christian experience. The great mystics tend to recognize that whatever God is, he or she does not need our protection or perfect understanding. All our words, dogmas, and rituals are like children playing in a sandbox before infinite mystery and wonderment. If anything is true, then it has always been true, and people who sincerely search will touch upon the same truth in every age and culture while using different language, symbols, and rituals to point us in the same direction. The direction is always toward more love and union, and in ever-widening circles. If you've ever traveled to India, you will realize that Hinduism is less a religion there and more of a 5,000-year-old culture formed by ancient sources such as the Vedas, the Upanishads, and the Bhagavad Gita, and communicated in thousands of other ways. Hinduism is the product of millennia of deep self-observation, human history, a confluence of cultures, and innumerable people seeking the divine and seeking themselves. Hinduism is much more comfortable with pluriformity and multiplicity than are the three religions of the book. This is symbolized by thousands of gods and dozens of primary deities in Hindu literature and tradition. Christians have surely dismissed polytheism too quickly as wrong or with nothing to teach us. Claiming monotheism as their religion has allowed Western believers to worship ideologies like communism, capitalism, jihadism, and success consumerism without recognizing that they are indeed our real and operative gods. And like all gods, they are always above question. We are de facto polytheists ourselves while pretending to have one God before us. On a related note, the best way to be captured by a heresy is to pretend to have condemned it. Christians condemned polytheism and verbally affirmed our strict monotheism while fully allowing ourselves to be polytheist in practice. We did the same with Gnosticism, pretending to dismiss it as a heresy in almost every century under a different name, while most of Christianity floated blissfully along in its head, which is the exact meaning of Gnostic. Mirabai Starr shares this: Hinduism is actually quite monotheistic, or better said, monistic. The Upanishads assert that there is only one supreme divine reality. The ancient diverse tradition led to the overwhelming consensus and conclusion that the Atman, true self, individual consciousness, is the same as Brahman, God. This is summarized in the well-known Sanskrit phrase, Tattvam Asi, loosely translated as, Thou art that. This is the final extent and triumph of non-dual thinking. God and the soul are united as one. Hinduism's maturity, which allows it to refrain from argumentation, is shown in its respect for at least four basic personality types and four stages of life. This provides much more human variety and patience with individual growth and understanding, and it moves people toward both tolerance and compassion. The Hindu religion does not tend to be highly organized around one right belief or one right ritual or any uniform seminary training. This, of course, can be seen as either its greatest strength or its greatest weakness. But I cannot deny that people wander in great numbers in and out of temples all day, every day in India and Nepal, while many Christian churches have a hard time filling up even once each Sunday morning. You don't need an elite priesthood for people to light candles, bow, sit in silence, offer flowers, chant, or pour oil over sacred stones. Hindu children just watch, and the reverence and respect is passed on to other generations, while we Christians argue in academies about theories of justification and who is worthy to go to communion, and that is what we too often pass on, not quiet worship of mystery, but noisy ideas about which we are certain. Let us take this moment for quiet worship of mystery. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. As I mentioned, there is allowance for great variety within Hinduism. Surely there are some temperamentally rigid Hindus, but the religion of itself emphasizes concrete practices, yogas, which allow practitioners to know things for themselves. I often wonder if conservative Christians are afraid of the word yoga because they are in fact afraid of concrete orthopraxy. They prefer to strongly believe things but have very few daily practices or yogas. The summary belief in Hinduism is that there are four disciplines, yogas, towards which different temperaments tend to gravitate. The word yoga comes from the Sanskrit for the yoke which unites the seeker with the sought. Hindus believe that all four yogas can lead one to enlightenment. In other words, there are at least four foundationally different ways of praying and living in the world. Carl Jung built on these in his human typology of feelers, thinkers, judgers, and perceivers, now used in the Myers-Briggs personality indicator. Yet the West was too often tended to try to fit everyone into one and the same box. In Catholicism, at least they had Benedictine, Carmelite, Franciscan, Charity, and Ignatian spiritualities, along with many others. The four basic Hindu disciplines are Bhakti Yoga, the way of feeling, love, and the heart, which is often preferred by Christianity and most mystics. Then there's Jnana Yoga, the way of knowledge, understanding, and wisdom, or head-based enlightenment, preferred by some forms of Buddhism. Karma Yoga, the way of action, engagement, and work, which can be done in either a knowledge way or a service way, a heart way, preferred by both Judaism and Islam. Raja Yoga, this roughly corresponds to experimentation or trial and error with mind and body through practices and empirical honesty about inner life and the world, preferred by Hinduism itself. And it might surprise you that Judaism includes these four disciplines as well, of course by different names. Each of these paths leads to union with the supreme reality. Raja Yoga focuses on the mind's ability to create our world through 8 sequential steps, ending in enlightenment. The first is yamas, the 5 moral thou shall nots, calling for nonviolence, truthfulness, moderation in all things, no stealing, and not being covetous. Niyamas, these are five shall nots requiring purity, contentment, austerity, study of the sacred text, and constant awareness of and surrender to divine presence. Asanas, this is postures. Westerners typically use the word yoga to simply mean asanas. Pranayama, controlling the breath. Pratyahara, withdrawal of the senses. Dharana, concentration of the mind. Dhyana, meditation. And samadhi, enlightenment, union with the divine. Hinduism teaches that there are four major stages of life: the student, the householder, the forest dweller, which is the retiree from business as usual, and four, the wise or fully enlightened person, who is not overly attached to anything or is detached from everything and thus ready for death. These four stages, represented in four stained glass windows in a Catholic church in Bangalore, showing how central this cultural paradigm is. Western cultures tend to recognize and honor the first two stages at best. Seeing this missing piece in our society, Richard Rohr developed initiation rites, which he explains in a book titled Adam's Return, and explored later stages of that in his book Falling Upward. His experience tells him that when you do not do the third and fourth stages, you actually lose both the skills and the elders to do the first and second stages too. This is foundational to understanding the spiritual problems we are experiencing in Western religion and culture today, and probably why we now seem to have an epidemic of mental and emotional illness. It seems so many people are angry today, especially at religion itself. They are angry because they do not honor variety, staging, interiority, or depth, but their attachment to that very anger becomes their major hindrance itself. Hinduism at its best honors staging, timing, ripening, and maturity, and not just the zeal and fervor of the newly born again. We see the same mature understanding in Christianity in the mansions of Teresa of Avila and in the knights of John of the Cross, but this seldom mainline Catholicism, which taught moral sin to seven-year-olds and was quite content with elderly people living in fear of God and fear of hell. What a huge loss of potential and holiness. In the first half of life, the student and householder stages in Hinduism, the focus is on developing an ego, a separate self. It's all about being safe and law-abiding and doing the right practices. This is as it should be. It teaches the ego necessary impulse control. The problem is when we get stuck and stay here. Unless we move toward maturity, we will miss the real purpose and meaning of our existence and become over-identified with our small, faithful self, and our practices too often become catatonic, unconscious repetition. I know Christians who attend church every day or read the Bible every day and are still in the kindergarten of prayer and love. The first half of life is about building a strong container. The second half is about discovering the contents the container was meant to hold, yet far too often solidifying one's personal container becomes a substitute for finding the contents themselves. The second half of life, represented by the forest dweller and the wise, enlightened person, moves the willing individual beyond the basic needs for separateness, status, and security to an awareness of their eternal, unchangeable identity as one with others and with God. Your concern becomes not so much to have what you love, but to love what you have. In the second part of life, you have a great sense of freedom, no longer attached to outcomes, but intimately involved in the process and relationships. You can trust that all will be well because all is held by love and divine presence. Let us take this moment to connect with love and divine presence. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. The practice this week is pranayama. Pranayama means controlled breathing. Prana is life's force or energy. Pranayama is willfully changing of one's energy, often through the breath, using variations of inhalation, exhalation, and sometimes holding the breath. From God's breath we were created, and from breath life continues. Prana, as breath, is inhaled into the body, carrying with it the essence of the life. Within our being, it is transformed, as well as transforming. Exhaled, it carries our essence, our unique energetic print. It is all one breath. So you're invited into this simple practice of pranayama called Ujjayi, ocean-sounding breath. This breath is slow, deep, and deliberate. Focusing on the sound is an effective technique to quiet the mind. It is very helpful in reducing mind chatter and preparing for meditation or relaxation. Sit comfortably with your feet flat on the ground and your hands relaxed on your thighs. Close your eyes or lower your gaze. Through your nose, slowly breathe in and out while partially restricting your throat. It may help to imagine your throat as the size of a straw. This breath creates an audible sound, at least audible to you. An alternative image is to exhale out of your mouth as if you are fogging a mirror, making a long ha sound. After trying it this way, close your mouth and repeat the exhalation through the nose. Put it together slowly, drawing the breath in and out of the nose. Imagine you are on the shore. The water draws back into the ocean on the inhalation and rolls out onto the shore as you exhale. Use your breath and limitless imagination to hear the ocean sound. Thank you for being with me. As you go out into your day and into the rest of the week, may all be held together by love and divine presence. Blessings to all.